Department, and that it is a real pleasure to have the opportunity to welcome Professor Elizabeth Outgood of Florida State. As many of you know, in addition to being a brilliant scholar of modernism and 20th century British culture, Professor Outgood also happens to be the sister of our much beloved, sorely missed former colleague, Paul Outgood, who left us last year to take up a position at the University of Kansas. So we feel doubly blessed that she's able to visit us in Tallahassee for this colloquium. Not only do we have the chance to hear Elizabeth's talk today, but we also can get at least a little dose of Outgoodness, if I can make that a noun, to help soften the blow of Paul's absence. Professor Outgood received her PhD from the University of Virginia and is currently an associate professor of English at the University of Richmond, where she specializes in late 19th and early 20th century British literature and culture. Her first book, titled Consuming Traditions, Modernity, Modernism, and the Commodified Authentic, was published by Oxford University Press as the inaugural book in its exciting new book series in Modernist Studies. Her essays have appeared in various journals, including Modernism, Modernity, Contemporary Literature, and Novel, and she's currently at work on a new study, Raising the Dead, War, Plague, Magic, Modernism, which argues that two catastrophes, World War I and the 1918 flu pandemic, dramatically altered our perceptions of the corpse. Apparently the new book even involves some extensive discussion of zombies, as well as magic shows, seances, and even some modernist fiction. But today we're going to be hearing about authenticity, not zombies, unfortunately, maybe. since its publication, Professor Outgood's first book has been hailed as a major intervention in studies of modernism, one that helps us move beyond stale, dualistic debates about whether modernism disdained or embraced popular culture and the market. With great historical specificity, Outgood takes up a wide range of cultural materials, both high and low, everything from Selfridge's department store in London to Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster, in order to explore the paradoxical status of the authentic within turn-of-the-century British culture and modernist literature. Rather than seeing the commercial and the supposedly genuine or authentic as opposed categories, or as bad versus good, Outgood's book brings them together and demonstrates how intertwined they became in the early 20th century. To better understand this intersection and to better theorize the constructedness of authenticity itself, Outgood introduces the fascinating concept of the commodified authentic. This term helps her isolate the emergence of a new, modern form of commodity that paradoxically commercialized the idea of authenticity and tradition, put those in quotation marks, and turned it into something marketable. For example, in objects that were mass-produced and fabricated, but at the same time nostalgically presented themselves as somehow outside the marketplace, as embodiments of an authentic, pre-commercial world. Outgood's central concept is a highly portable one, the kind of idea that one immediately wants to start testing and applying to various time periods and spheres of culture. In a recent review of Consuming Traditions, Douglas Mao wrote, "I expect the phrase commodified authentic to enter very quickly the regular vocabulary of modernist studies," and argued that, quote, "other scholars will surely build on the ground Elizabeth Outgood has ingeniously broken." And certainly he's right. Professor Outgood's book already has had an important impact, not only on studies of modernism, but also on broader theoretical debates like the ones we're having today about the nature of authenticity as a concept. We're very fortunate to have her here today to talk about this question with us. So please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Outgood.
Thanks to Florida State for having me here. I'm really delighted to be here. It's been a pleasure working with Jerry and Candace and putting this all together. So, as I was telling people before I started here, using slides at all in a presentation is very new to me. So we will see. I think I have the technology down. It's not especially complicated. And we'll see how it works. I'd like to cross into dangerous territory this morning and consider what happens when ideas of authenticity, already a contested and often problematic term, start to cavort with our favorite bad boy, commerce. We are today surrounded by marketing appeals to authenticity. In one version, we have nostalgic forms of authentic objects and atmospheres. Disney World's pristine Main Street USA, Cracker Barrel's general store, replete with its old-fashioned candy jars and moon pies amid a faux rusticated interior. Pottery Barn's new distressed furniture, machine-made to look old and weathered. the ye olde English shop aesthetic, and that's two P's and an E on the shop, and the list could go on. In a related category, the commodification of authenticity can imply not quite nostalgia, but rather a purified aesthetic, one miraculously and allegedly purged of the vulgar stain of commerce. Here we find the soft-focus Ralph Lauren ad, the fireside scene of the L.L. Bean Christmas catalog with its golden retriever puppies reclining on soft flannel, and the solid sophistication with lovely wood accents of the venerable London store Liberty. Recipients of restoration hardware catalogs, as well as critical journals, we rightly remain suspicious about attempts to commodify authenticity. Indeed, the proliferation of such marketing is matched by the proliferation of critics who decry the phenomenon. We usually perceive the selling of authenticity as fraud, as the inauthentic masquerading as the authentic, and accordingly we are adept at, and often smug about, unmasking the commerce behind the facade. The distressed furniture is not really old. The soft-lit reproduction of the villager's house hides the darker poverty that was found there. And at the very least, that new soft sweater is unlikely to deliver the sophisticated atmosphere from the catalog. We know all of this. Such exposure is important in ongoing critical work, but the rush to condemn, or at least ironically smirk, has limited a critical investigation of either the history of such marketing or its powerful allures. Like everything else, the commercial selling of authenticity has a history. And I'd like to take us to a particular time and place to explore its development, an acutely unstable moment in British culture at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, when in one generation Britain shifted from the Victorian era to the modern one. This enormous shift produced what would appear to be two contradictory commitments. On the one hand, in this period, there were unprecedented commercial possibilities for self-fashioning, for performing a range of new identities, and for creating any number of particular lifestyles. On the other hand, these very possibilities of change in turn produced an intense longing for stability, for permanence, and for something authentic to set against the flux. We naturally think of these two sides in opposition, but in fact what emerged in Britain was a half-hidden but pervasive phenomenon that brought the two sides together, a phenomenon I call the commodified authentic. New marketing strategies, in advertising, in store design, in ideas of community planning, and in architecture, rapidly created a particular kind of commercial hybrid that fused, or promised to fuse, artifice and authenticity. Innovative possibilities of construction and reinvention were carefully linked to ideas that would, at least at first, seem antithetical to interchangeable identities and lifestyles, such as nostalgic evocations of a pre-industrial world past, appeals to an original, genuine article, and images of a purified aesthetic free from any taint of the mass market. New objects and places were packaged and sold as mini representations of these supposedly non-commercial ideas, bringing Britain a flood of new but old-looking furniture and houses and new opportunities to create authentic reproductions. It was not simply that marketers were appropriating areas that had traditionally been seen as non-commercial, however. What made these efforts so distinctive, and what contemporary critics have often missed, is how intrinsic the commercial origins were to the allure of these objects and places. Their non-commercial aura made them appealing. Their underlying commercial availability promised to make the simulation better than the original. For these new hybrids were accessible, controllable, and, in their ability to unite seemingly antithetical desires, tantalizingly modern. Indeed, I work to redefine modern as, in part, the unity of contradictory desires for authenticity and commercial availability. This non-commercial commerce was certainly a paradox, but the powerful underlying promise was that the intrinsic contradictions could be sustained rather than resolved. The paradox was the appeal. I use the term commodified authentic as a useful shorthand for this enormously complex and important phenomenon. The term does not imply a search for authenticity per se, but rather a search for a sustained contradiction that might allow consumers to be modern by connecting to a range of values roughly aligned with authenticity. Its emergence represents a critical but neglected moment in the history of modernity. It shaped not only the commercial development of the 20th century, but also the development of British culture in general and British modernism in particular. In fact, the ideas that fueled the commodified authentic became critical tools for modernism and its construction. For the very idea of a constructed authenticity, implying as it does both an innovative self-fashioning and an elegiac longing for permanence or an enduring originality, lies at the heart of literary modernism and offers a distinctly new way to read modernism's many contradictions. Let me introduce several subtypes of commodified authenticity at the turn of the century, and then I'll turn to a cluster of examples, drawing on the work of Henry James, H.G. Wells, and the revolutionary commercial changes inspired by the 1909 launch of the London department store Selfridges. In the book from which this talk is drawn, I explore in detail three central manifestations of the commodified authentic that, taken together, all heralded the profound marketing shift from commodity fetishism to lifestyle design and the possibilities of performance that that move generated. Starting in early 20th century Britain, marketers began to focus less on a particular object for sale at a particular price. And as you can see here, here's a typical collection of ads with the product and the price right next to it, and more on aura and setting, promising consumers not single products, but new identities and new ways to live. This strategy is extremely familiar to us. It's so familiar, it's a climate. But it was quite new at the turn of the century in advertising. I'll have more to say about that in a moment. Promising consumers not single products, but new identities and new ways to live. Consumers were drawn to the transformative possibilities and also to the sense of permanence and refinement individual examples might offer. This shift was not simply a transition from formally fixed identities or lives to the mobile flux brought by modernity, but a simultaneous embrace of modernity's promise of exchange and the equally alluring promise of authenticity. The first version drew on commercialized versions of a nostalgic nationalism. Such marketing evoked an ideal English rural past, usually one that predated industrial production and modern technology, and often one that was situated in the country. And I'll get to more, don't worry. This ye olde England aesthetic evoked misty images of happy craftspeople at their looms and benches, the gentle pastoral scene, the cozy domestic interior. This one takes a moment to come up. It's big. While nostalgia for a pastoral tradition had long been a staple of British culture, the turn of the century witnessed an especially intense revival of such nostalgia, as well as its aggressive commercialization. Critic Alan Hawkins describes the pervasive rise of Englishness in this era, a rural myth based loosely on an idealized vision of the late Elizabethan period and on ideas of southern England that involved quaint villages, cultivated land, and a sense of classlessness, or at least class harmony. We can follow strains of such nostalgia in the arts and crafts movement of John Ruskin and William Morris, who enthusiastically promoted the virtues of carefully crafted handmade goods. Traditionally, this type of nostalgic authenticity had been defined in part by its separation from the mass market and the factory system. At the turn of the century, however, there was an explosion of efforts to mass produce and market this nostalgic vision. Such marketing was reflected both in the rapid rise of town planning efforts, such as the Garden City movement, and in new designs of individual domestic homes. Nostalgic authenticity with a nationalist flavor quickly became a staple of advertising and influenced such ventures as the launch of Country Life magazine in 1897, still going strong, and the start of the Daily Mail's Ideal Home exhibition in 1908, also still going strong. While manifestations of this nostalgia differed in form, what united all these efforts was the central appeal of the contradiction, a constructed, marketed aesthetic of things that might be easily obtained and exchanged, infused with the contrary images of stability, permanence, and the non-commercial. Consumers might have it all. The advantages of the country image without the rigid feudal hierarchy, the pastoral without the toil, the old-looking cottage without the primitive plumbing. Late Victorian and Edwardian writers such as Bernard Shaw and E.M. Forster presented scathing critiques of such efforts of nostalgic authenticity, but they also understood how powerful and appealing such images might be and how essential they were to a changing nation. Emerging alongside the commodified nostalgia was the selling of an alternative version of authenticity, one defined by innovation. This form, what I term the originary authentic, equated authenticity with the original, or the one of a kind, something that was not a copy and that was not derived from previous traditions. The mystique of the originary object had long been felt, but the turn of the century saw its rapid emergence as a powerful advertising strategy. As with the nostalgic form, the originary authentic was in part defined by and valued for its alleged separation from the mass market, and it was likewise aggressively marketed in what are now familiar strategies, appeals to the coterie, to high fashion, to the limited edition. Part of the originary's allure was its evocation of the prototype. One was not buying the general, but the genuine, the first model from which others might be made. The originary authentic at times had a nostalgic tint. The aura of an original artwork, for example, might be valued in part for its reference to a venerable past. At other times, however, the authenticity that was evoked was one of novelty, of being the first, the cutting edge, the new. As with the nostalgic variety, the power of selling the originary authentic lay in its contradictory promise. Middle-class consumers might allegedly have both the genuine article and something they could purchase, both the exclusive and the accessible, the original as the perfect reproduction. Such appeals quickly became a popular marketing technique, and literary modernists, who were themselves often linked to a supposedly non-marketed originary authenticity, became adept purveyors of such strategies. Writers and marketers alike recognized the power of boldly declaring that something had no precursors, that it was the first of its kind, beholden to no tradition, and, at the same time, to understand this very appeal as a deliberately and usefully constructed artifice. Efforts to promote the originary authentic were forcefully represented by the particular attractions of literal and literary versions of the modern show window, where the glass promised simultaneously this cutting-edge availability and an out-of-reach allure. I won't, unfortunately, have time this morning to explore window displays in any detail, though I'd be happy to answer questions about them. But here's one, anyway. Alongside the nostalgic and the originary versions of the commodified authentic, there also emerged a third version, one that commercialized the supposedly pure realms of aesthetic pleasure and refinement. Commerce had long been understood as corrupting, always threatening to intrude on the realm of true art. At the turn of the century, however, both marketers and writers imagined new heights of aesthetic and sensual pleasures that were not only not sullied by their union with commerce, but purified by it. New department stores such as Selfridges sought to reclaim commerce from its shadowy role as the perverter of artistic refinements, carefully recasting commerce as the powerful and appealing purveyor of bountiful aesthetic pleasures previously reserved for the upper class. Middle-class customers were suddenly promised environments and objects that evoked a high-class aesthetic refinement, where the commercial exchange was de-emphasized to imply that the spaces and objects were always already purchased and that nothing so crass as an exchange of money would be involved. At the same time, customers were invited to produce the refined atmosphere within their own homes by choosing from the many goods that surrounded them. So I presented these three approaches as distinct, but of course in practice one often blended into another, as we'll see in my examples. But before I turn to those examples, let me note one central issue I discovered as I researched these early versions of the commodified authentic, an issue that necessarily gets short attention in this brief talk. The commodified authentic should be seen on a continuum. On the one end, the strategy can merely be an empty promise, a rather crass selling of an object or an environment with little substance or advantages. This is an actual hat, actually. But at the other end, some examples offered quite real benefits, most notably model factory towns such as Bourneville or Port Sunlight. These towns were deliberately designed to evoke a nostalgic version of authentic English country villages, while at the same time being quite upfront that this environment was sustained by modern commercial ventures, not somewhere else, but right in the center of town, like the Cadbury Chocolate and the Sunlight soap factories that were in the middle of these towns. Their careful attention to design and community living meant that the inhabitants of these areas enjoyed substantially better health than others at the time. The commodified authentic often bestowed other surprising benefits, particularly to the middle class, who suddenly had greater access to objects and environments previously out of reach. Such goods might have been imitations, but that also meant they were available for purchase. Not everyone has the opportunity to have weathered original furniture, and thus demands for a pure authenticity can, at times, hide a kind of class snobbery. I want to turn now to those examples and to explore in greater depth the extraordinary commercial changes set in motion by the launch of Selfridge's department store. I'll use two literary models to bookend this analysis. First, Henry James' short story, The Great Good Place, captures with precision the emerging commercial revolution in early 20th century British culture. James presents a fantasy of escape, a commercial ticket out of the press of urban modernity. H.G. Wells' novel Tono Bungay, which I'll analyze at the end of my Selfridge's material, offers a derisive critique of this same commercial revolution, mocking advertising in general and attempts to commodify authenticity in particular. Taken together, the two authors present a critical model for investigating Selfridge's innovations, and in their contradictory stances, they articulate the divisions that would come to dominate reactions to the emerging commercial strategies. Henry James offers a surprising embrace of commercial possibilities in his short story, The Great Good Place, capturing the allure of the commodified authentic for the weary urban resident. The tale depicts a successful English man of letters, George Dane, who is overwhelmed by the products of modern literary life. A steady stream of manuscripts, poems, journals, reviews, and novels pours into his London study each day, pushing Dane to the brink of mental and physical collapse. And at the end of term, I think we can all feel his pain. He is saved, however, by his sudden magical transportation to the Great Good Place, an idyllic retreat far from the rush of modernity. The place gives Dane the chance to leave behind the modern madness, the mere maniacal extension and motion, and to rejuvenate his aesthetic sensibilities in his inner life. Dane finds the retreat rich in iconic markers of authenticity and tranquility, and he describes it variously as the bright country house, the sacred silent convent, an old Italian picture, and some great, mild, invisible mother. That's my favorite. All united into one lovely and refined package of satisfaction. The place combines nostalgic recompense and aesthetic refinement, blending images evocative of an authentic rural past, the country house, the Italian countryside, with visions drawing on authentic artistic creation, a fine poem, an exquisite piece of music. Dane sinks into the luxury of the retreat, immersing himself in the rejuvenating powers of its pleasures. The place may be linked to traditionally non-commercial locations, but Dane and the other guests must nevertheless pay for their experience. As Dane learns, payment was definite. It consisted of sovereigns and shillings, just like those of the world he had left, only parted with more ecstatically. While the actual monetary exchange is discreet, guests leave money in their rooms and it is taken away silently and secretly. Money underlies the visit. The arrangements are consistently presented in commercial terms. The guests and the place have a contract, and what was offered was guaranteed. Guests had no concern but to pay. Surprisingly, however, James makes explicit that much of Dane's pleasure arises from the retreat's commercial nature rather than in spite of it. Dane is well aware and yet untroubled by the knowledge that he's buying the aesthetic representation of the non-commercial, where satisfaction is intrinsically tied up with the idea that the place is not for sale and yet available for purchase. The market does not intrude on the aesthetic pleasures, as a reader might expect. It guarantees them. For the commercial nature of the place made it available, accessible, and most importantly, controllable. Dane and the other guests may return at will simply by paying the fees. It is a comfort rather than a disappointment that all the sweetness and serenity were created calculated things. For it means that the guests might come again whenever they felt the need, and they might feel in full control of its nature. They might really call it anything in the world they liked, the thing, for instance, they'd loved it most for being. Dane and another guest consider with relief that the place is likely to continue because of its profit motive. It isn't, thank goodness, carried on only for love, but rather because it pays. The retreat, in fact, bears an uncanny resemblance to the continuous loop of desire and production that intrinsic to the modern market. The guests seem to create the place through their own desires. As Dane notes, one's vision seems less from the facts than the facts from one's vision. The elements were determined at the moment by the moment's need or the moment's sympathy. Knowing its market intimately, the place reflects back to the guests their own aesthetic sensibilities, perfectly suited to that moment in time. Likewise, the place also awakens desire. Dane discusses with another guest the surprise and relief they felt at finding such a place existed. It was just what they wanted and needed, though they themselves could not have articulated this solution before they came. Their desire is sparked by the existence of the place. James implies here the feedback loop that sustains the modern market. Desire produces product, product produces desire. The place becomes simultaneously a retreat from modernity and the modern selling of such a retreat. James himself does not critique the commercial nature of this full-service spa and seems uninterested in exposing the Great Good Place as false or engaged in bad faith efforts to hide its real intent. Dane's choices are an overwhelming modernity that churns out endless literary productions, or an alternative modernity that presents a kind of distilled authenticity in a new commercial package. Dane, James implies, is right to embrace this modern solution, and in fact, the place works as Dane's salvation. When Dane had got his soul again, he finds himself magically transported back to his apartment. To his relief, he discovers all his work has been completed by another capable young man. I need this man in my office. The rest cure restores Dane fully. He rises from his couch and finds his room seems disencumbered, different, twice as large. It was all right. The commercial retreat has, in fact, sustained the artist. Just 9 years later, another American in England discovered the practical applications of the atmosphere James describes. Gordon Selfridge, a self-made millionaire from Chicago, set out to transform British commerce with the opening of Selfridge's department store in 1909, marking a pivotal moment in British marketing. London's greatest store perfected the commercial selling of the non-commercial, paradoxically inscribing within its elegantly decorated interior a retail location allegedly unsullied by trade. Visitors on the store's opening day found a luxurious, almost enchanted space, where soft lighting illuminated the vast array of goods from clothes to china to books, where price tags were absent, or at least discreet, and where concealed string quartets provided a soothing musical accompaniment for the spectators. In this new commercial environment, the message was that even large-scale stores would deliver a refined atmosphere where the shoppers, or guests as Selfridge has called them, they each got a little key on opening day, would find an abundance of authentic and exclusive objects, not to be confused with the lesser goods available elsewhere. And you can actually see how the aesthetic is brought into the architecture of the exterior of the store. And I can talk more about that later if you want. But you can see how it was designed to look like a government building or a museum. And yet, along the edges there, it has the largest plate glass windows at the time were at Selfridge's. So it was itself an amalgamation of different styles. This extraordinary atmosphere marked a dramatic realignment of London's commercial energies, representing one of the first mass market campaigns to sell a disdain for the mass market. Our first destination on the Selfridge's shopping excursion is to the goods themselves and the unique form of commercial erasure Selfridge's mastered within its initial flood of advertisements. The marketing campaign to announce the store's opening was unprecedented. Gordon Selfridge hired 38 of the best illustrators in London, headed by Sir Bernard Partridge from Punch, and commissioned them to create over 100 full-page advertisements for 18 different newspapers, along with half and quarter-page advertisements. He spent an extraordinary £36,000, which doesn't sound like a lot by today's standards, but it was unprecedented, to promote his new store before opening day. Within this initial campaign, and for several months following, Selfridge's worked to distance its goods from hints of trade, both by evoking a nostalgic aura around the production process and by linking the goods to various markers of high-class taste. At the same time, Selfridge Selfridge has deliberately unmasked these efforts, insisting, often in the same advertisements, that the goods were easy to purchase, plentiful, and available to all. By both unsettling and reinscribing distinctions between a low commercial commerce and a high non-commercial one, Selfridge has offered shoppers a chance to enjoy both the distinction and the pleasures of transcending it. A central early advertising strategy for Selfridges involved the nostalgic version of the commodified authentic, a strategy that cast a misty glow over the production process and implied that the goods were made not en masse in factories, but the old-fashioned way, in small cottage industries that transferred that purification to product and eventually to the buyer. As one example, consider this image, which shows one of Selfridge's article advertisements that appeared in the Times in the weeks before the store opened. By mimicking the paper's news stories, the layout emphasizes the continuity between the established and less obviously commercial news of the Times and the new news about Selfridges. The writer relates here how Selfridges gathers its goods from all parts of the world. On romantic journeys, buyers scour the globe looking for distinctive original articles made at home or in these cottage industries. The advertisement decries the mass-produced nature of most goods made by machines churning out identical finished products. This painful uniformity, however, has been addressed by avid Selfridges buyers. Forever in search of the original, they seek goods that strike a distinctive and individual note. To this end, the buyers try to find the original makers of articles, going literally off the high road of commerce to penetrate into little-known villages and sequestered districts where manufacturers are still carried on in a simple human way by men and women whose workshop is their home and who themselves are artists in their crafts rather than artisans. Selfridges shoppers can, as it were, buy this authenticity located in vague references to peasants, the countryside, home industry, and timeless traditions, and set against the impersonal forces of mechanization, industry, and mass-produced objects. The nostalgic authentic lies not simply in the past, but in the way a connection to a tradition becomes inscribed onto an object. These objects are made in the home by an individual who creates an object that embodies his own personality in its very distinctiveness. The objects come to stand in metonymically for the authenticity located in the production process and in the peasants themselves. And such objects brought to Selfridges can, the advertisement implies, not only bestow on the store this sense of distinctiveness, but can in turn bestow on the shopper's home the sense of authenticity originally located in the cottage industry. By simultaneously advancing and erasing production, Selfridges sought to sell the very kind of authenticity that a writer such as Ian Forster would see as antithetical to London's commercial district. The buyer could shop in a capitalist market without taint, could return with carefully selected purchases to an earlier mythic past located in an imagined pre-industrial world. Evoking such an idealized production process was certainly nothing new. Selfridges drew on Victorian traditions such as the arts and crafts movements, for William Morris, along with a host of precursors and followers, had imagined a similar production process. Morris, who exposed the actual factory conditions of the peasants whom Selfridges mythologized, praised the many virtues of handmade and carefully crafted goods. What marked Selfridges as a departure, however, was how the store borrowed these refined models of commerce and then deployed them in a structured mass market campaign. Such a strategy certainly served an ideological function, hiding the bleak conditions that likely went into producing these goods. As one article heading notes, the Selfridges buyers ransacked the world for the products. The strategy also served an intriguing cultural function, however, promising to address the emerging disdain for mass market production. A close cousin to the nostalgic version of the commodified authentic blended a Morris-like attachment to the handcrafted item with a high-class aesthetic purity, and this combines the last two categories I introduced earlier. A second example from print advertising, this ad we've seen before for famous Ticoware, offers a contrast for the reader between the cluttered, hard-to-read news and the three refined pottery pieces in the advertisements. Tico, says the copy, is without a doubt the refinement of pottery. It cannot be described by word or picture, but each piece is a chaste, dignified, refined, and valuable specimen of pottery, unique in its kind and suggestive of the reincarnation of a lost art, Every piece is an embodiment of the genius of a well-known artist and bears its designer's name to attest its individual character. These are works of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, suggesting not copies but the original objects from which lesser imitations for sale at lesser stores might be made. The selvedge shopper can obtain objects that, in effect, predate any commercial contamination. The goods are surrounded with the language of art rather than the language of commerce. And while this, of course, remains a commercial strategy, one familiar to modern readers, it was a new trend for British advertisers. Such advertising techniques represented a marked departure for London stores. For comparison's sake, consider another early Selfridges advertisement along with an ad that appeared the same month, one from Debenham and Freebody. The Debenham ad, typical of those used by many stores at the time, promotes trimmings and reproduces several selections of different styles. Prices are clearly marked in bold numbers, and each article has a short description just underneath or beside it. The emphasis in such advertisements is on the specific articles that are for sale and the price for which the reader can obtain them. No attempt is made to hide ideas of selling or to make any claims about the mission or character of the store. Selfridges offers a clear contrast to such advertising, often emphasizing atmosphere over price and object. The ad here uses archetypal classical imagery, a mini idyllic country scene. It's hard to see, but in between the two figures, there's a little sort of countryside that rises in the distance. And then on top of the clouds is the Selfridges rising like heaven. It's silly, right? It's silly, sure. But at the time, this approach was quite innovative, uniting Selfridges with a range of established markers and presenting a rebranded vision of commerce to London readers. And incidentally, Selfridges, by most accounts, was a great place to work, in part because Gordon Selfridge insisted on this kind of community village atmosphere among his employees and sent them to school, sent them to extra additional classes. The pay was good. They're actually making a mini-series. BBC is coming up with a mini-series on Selfridges department store. right alongside, I want them to bring me in. Right alongside these efforts to present the goods as one-of-a-kind objects, the print advertising simultaneously evoked the mass market narrative. Goods were plentiful, they were readily available, they were sold at prices accessible to most buyers. Within the same article advertisement I was quoting from earlier that declared that the goods at Selfridges were made in cottage industries, the writer declares, Selfridges will sell nearly everything that any man, woman, or child may require or desire from the day of birth throughout life. I won't read you the whole thing. Clothes, hats, books, jewelry, you get the idea. Not heavy furniture. There's a story there, but it's not important. The store would be a veritable cornucopia of the latest goods. Shoppers might take pleasure in the goods' uniqueness, but might simultaneously take pleasure in the goods' abundance. Selfridges' suggestive recreations of non-commercial environments and the interesting class and gender mobility such recreations promised were literally represented in the store's interior. A shopper could experience an intriguing geographic hierarchy of monetary associations by simply walking through the store. A shopper might begin in the bargain basement, where the lowest floor accessible to the public, where an enormous mass of goods was jumbled together, and where low prices were the central theme. She could travel upwards to the more exclusive floors, visiting departments where goods were tastefully arranged and price tags available but not obvious. As the efficient lift whisked her to higher floors, she could relax in elegantly decorated lounging rooms. There was a library, a room of silence. No tipping was allowed. It's fascinating. She could write a letter, read a book, simply rest. She might enjoy a home-cooked meal in one of the restaurants, or continuing to the roof, simply sit in an English country garden, which was recreated on the roof. The farther up she went in the building, the farther away she moved from actual material transactions, where money was exchanged for specific objects. The shopper could, in effect, choose the environment in which she shopped, and by extension, select the class and even gender associations she wished to perform. Within the store, the identity of both class and gender might be created and maintained within objects and also elided by their ready exchange within a seemingly infinite, expanding market of goods. This sort of mobility was not necessarily liberating. I'm not claiming that. But neither was it necessarily a sinister manipulation. Selfridges presented a new commercial landscape for London, one which used the purity implied in nostalgic laments or markers of high-class taste, a purity usually invoked to place commercialism in the role of contaminated other, as central to the new definition of commerce. Many observers at the time, however, were alarmed at the emerging commercial strategies. Novelist H.G. Wells offered an extended critique in his novel Tono Bungay. Published in book form the same year Selfridges opens, his work is an elaborate exposure of advertising in general and attempts to commodify authenticity in particular, presenting the dirty underside of any great good place that marketing might evoke. The novel's main character moves from his early life as the son of a servant at an old country estate to being a business partner with his uncle, the inventor of Tono Bungay, an all-purpose tonic that would allegedly cure almost any ailment. The move at first suggests an evolution from the authentic to the inauthentic. At the start of the novel, the boy believes the country estate Bladesover. Oh, sorry, one slide behind, there's Tono Bungay. Believes that the country estate Bladesover represents an authentic England. As he relates, there came a time when I realized that Bladesover House was not all it seemed. But when I was a little boy, I took the place with the entirest faith as a complete authentic microcosm of the whole world. This early faith is gradually replaced by the narrator's growing realization that even Bladesover was a carefully created construct. As the narrator's uncle is made rich by a secret recipe and starts to move up the social scale, he turns from wanting a house full of new things to desiring expensive old ones. The narrator describes how this class of the newly wealthy evolves from its first crude conception of dazzling suites of the newly perfect to a jackdaw dream of accumulating costly, decrepit old things. The uncle soon decides he needs an old estate in the country, complete with the old traditions. As he remarks, "I'm all for getting that good old English spirit back again. Merrymakings, lads and lasses, dancing on the village green, harvest home, fairings, yule log, all the rest of it." In this political climate, we see the use of these sorts of appeals. Embodying laments at the time that wealthy conquerors simply wanted to appropriate rural traditions, the uncle seeks an idealized, easily commodified sense of the past. The narrator and his uncle later produce advertising campaigns for other firms, playing on various ideas of authenticity, creating a storied history for their client Moggs by writing magazine articles telling of the quaint past of Moggs. For another firm, we carried their origins back to the mists of antiquity, a strategy that would have been familiar at Selfridges. The narrator does wonder, however, whether these new industrialists are really changing anything, and whether the aristocrats at the Bladesovers were really any more authentic. Perhaps, the narrator muses, always possessions have been booty, and never anywhere has there been such a thing as house and furnishings native and natural to women and men who made use of them. The new inhabitants of Bladesover, after all, had not destroyed anything worth saving. As the narrator Riley remarks, one felt that a smaller but more enterprising and intensely undignified variety of stupidity had replaced the larger dullness of the old gentry, and that was all. The idea of some stable, authentic term that was being covered or erased by commerce is exposed as itself a sham. Wells ends his novel with a narrator on a barge, moving through London, down the Thames and out to sea. He passes first the essential London and what he calls the original England, with its railway stations and warehouses and factories. Then he moves to Blackfriars and St. Paul's, quote, the very figures of whatever fineness the old Anglican culture achieved, end quote, which has been forgotten and obscured by the steamships and barges and telephone wires and traffics. Finally, he reaches London Bridge, and the old order is altogether dwarfed and swallowed up. And, quote, the dear, neat, little, sunlit, ancient tower of London, lying in a gap among the warehouses, that little accumulation of buildings so provincially pleasant and dignified, overshadowed by the vulgarest, the most typical exploit of modern England, the sham Gothic casings to the ironwork of the Tower Bridge, end quote. Despite his discomfort with idealizing the old order, the narrator implies that the commercial spirit has infected London, the worst example being a sham reproduction of the Gothic, a mere copy of what Ruskin might have deemed the most authentic spiritual architecture. Read together, James, Selfridges, and Wells reveal critical tensions at the heart of the commodified authentic. We might see the two writers as bringing to clarity two distinct responses to ventures such as Selfridges. Wells represents the unmasker, the critic who seeks to expose the man behind the curtain. The position links Wells to a long critical history and to the culture's general but pervasive fear that the commercial promise will simply leave us gripping a worthless bottle of Tono Bungay. In James's story, George Dane represents an opposite position, one we might call the reveler. James reveals not simply the power of the commodified authentic, but its promised and delivered sensual pleasures. The Great Good Place may be a constructed dream, but this only heightens Dane's delight. If all commercial promises could simply be reduced, as Wells implies in his novel, to trickery, and God knows many of them can, they would not have the power they do. As I mentioned, commodified authentic must be seen on a continuum, for as James understood, sometimes it delivers. The marketing brilliance of the commodified authentic, as developed by Selfridges, is that its pleasures, in fact, demanded consumers understand the attitudes represented by both James and Wells. Naturally, consumers were invited to believe in the promises of authenticity Selfridges suggested, and visitors did, in fact, enjoy many of these pleasures, granting them powers often unavailable in their own homes. At the same time that consumers were invited to revel in authenticity, they also had to be adept at unmasking it, for unless they could see it as at least in part a construct, they would not in turn see it as a commodity they could buy. The commodified authentic inspired in consumers the conflicts described by Wells and James, and then promised to resolve them. The commodified authentic encapsulated and encapsulates a broad stream of competing concerns, a stream influenced by currents of nostalgia for an authentic commercial-free past, merging into another stream of desire for an authentically new future, not derived from an outmoded tradition. Currents that dream of exclusivity and a select audience flowing into currents that desire a ready accessibility and a wide market. Examining these currents force us to ask difficult questions about authenticity and its marketing, for at times they form an unholy alliance, one that can distort history and present a crass imitation of something valuable. Historically, though, at least in early 20th century Britain, the alliance also served as a potentially liberating, playful, mobile hybrid, one that helped ease the difficult transition from the Victorian age to the modern one. Our positions, both as consumers and critics, should be one of suspicion and attraction, of remaining alert to the dangers of the commodified authentic while recognizing its history and its possibilities.
Authentic and kitsch. On the one hand, it sort of seems like this idea is it's sort of a type of kitsch, or it's a way of talking about type of kitsch. And then on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, you know, maybe it's a different way of talking.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the difference as being that the commodified authentic, at least what I've been talking about, is more without irony. Right, whereas kitsch requires a kind of ironic stance that is sort of ongoing and upfront, whereas the commodified authentic invited a sort of serious embrace of the authenticity on one side, while an acknowledgement that it was constructed, but it wasn't. But the irony I don't find. I feel like that comes in later. It's a great question because you can see how kitsch emerges here. Yeah.
In talking about these commodities for the home as both sort of available and original at the same time, it made me think of the Omega Workshop. And
yes.
I was wondering if you could talk where you see the Omega Workshop productions fitting on this continuum.
Yeah, the Omega Workshop is certainly emerging, you know, at the same time. And I do talk about the Omega Workshop. It's... I think the difference is the mass marketed element, right? So that the Omega Workshop was very much not mass marketed, right? And understood as not mass marketed. And yet, there is that embrace of the commerce and the practical and the sort of day-to-day in the Omega Workshop that at least is a second cousin to the kinds of things that were emerging. And Selfridges does have several art exhibits, and there is some overlap. So yeah, that's kind of where I see it fitting. Yeah, Candace.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by the Cadbury ads,
yeah.
Cadbury chocolate ads, and I think in one of the early ones, the first is the logo. Is it a cocoa tree?
Yes.
Okay, and so the ad on the emphasis on purity. How is that working in that wider framework of racialized other, where the cocoa is produced and that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Cadbury's has a really sort of interesting interesting history. The purity there, I think, the cocoa plantations come up a little bit later. But the purity there is, near as I can tell from reading all of their documentation, the Cadbury documentation, was meant to be a contrast to industry. Right, to industry and factory. The Cadbury brothers were obsessed with housing, and looked at Birmingham as this terrible place to live for workers. And so they wanted to emphasize that their goods were not made in the city, but out in the countryside, in this idyllic community that they created for their workers, and that everything was clean and not tainted by the soot of the city. As though the conditions of the cocoa plantation started to come out, both the Cadbury brothers were devout Quakers, and as near as I can tell, like good people, right? They sent a person down to investigate and research the plantations for months, and he came back and he said it's a disaster, right? This is slavery, right? There is nothing that we can say that except that it's slavery. So then they started to work to try to figure out how to address that. So they are they're not totally pure, but they did some good things, and their chocolate was in fact made under cleaner conditions in the factories. It wasn't simply hype. But yeah, I could like Cadbury is, and Bourneville is the community that they built. Still a really thriving community, and was a great place to live. Its counterpart was Port Sunlight, which is where the soap was made, and it's still the factories there are still going strong. It's a little creepier. It's definitely a little more paternalistic, and yeah, there's all sorts of problems with Port Sunlight. But Cadbury ads are fascinating.
Yeah, I was kind of intrigued too about the Selfridges about going to the homes, the craftsman homes, and kind of plucking out. It immediately jumped into my mind, like, now fair trade ads.
Yes.
And that kind of.
Yes, 10,000 villages.
Yes.
You know, or you know, there's distinctions between to be made, right? Between 10,000 villages and Pier One, right? That one is. You know, politically a little more problematic, I would say. The Cadbury ads are really fascinating. Selfridges actually would bring craftspeople from all over England into the store and have them set up their looms or their printing press or whatever it is, and they would have these sort of this like kind of little village atmosphere where people would walk around. It was a piece of work, I tell you. Yeah, Jerry.
Elizabeth, could you clarify who is buying in that Selfridges? As you're describing it, it makes me think of Portman and Mason's rather than Selfridges. What?
Yeah, they were trying to. I mean, they were certainly trying to appeal to the upper class, but it's the upper middle class is who shop there, and the middle class, I would say. But the people who couldn't quite afford Bond Street, were sort of offered a Bond Street in miniature in Selfridges. Though Selfridges also made a big deal of getting some of their shop, people behind the counters were formerly titled, well, I guess still titled, but fallen on hard economic times. So they had sort of, I can't remember what the highest rank was, you know, a duchess or whatever it was, behind the counters. And they advertised that, you know, that you could be served by the upper classes in this store. But, you know, it was on Oxford Street, right? And if you know London geography, Oxford Street is where the big, the sort of, the Canal Street of London, maybe not quite that, but it's... it was associated with huge department stores but they were targeting the middle class for sure, or at least that's who ended up shopping there. Does that answer?
Sort of. Quite different than the exact economic level of the people who were shopping there.
I mean, I think it was a mix, and you, if you take a look at the ads that he took out, say in the Daily Mail versus the Times, right? There is a continuity, but he's talking a lot more about the authentic laborer in the Daily Mail, and a lot more about aristocratic privilege in the Times. So he was hoping, and he had, if you look in the archives, he had exact numbers on what the circulation were, the circulation and the readership for all of these different papers. So he really was trying not to appeal just to one class, but to try to shape his aesthetic so he could pull in everything. Just as, you know, Tommy Hilfiger has lines that he sells in one store versus lines he sells in another, trying to brand it to particular audiences. So I think it was a real mix. Yeah.
Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you about a slippage that I was hearing between Englishness and Britishness.
Yes.
That was going on. I mean, it's mostly English, and but every now and then it was British modernism, and I'm the Scottish guy here. And so this will sound like the sort of snarky version of, I can point to an earlier, and, you know, we can take the scam of the fake antique back forever.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm thinking particularly about the marketing of Scottishness in Romanticism, especially late Romanticism, post-Waterloo Romanticism. With, you know, is Walter Scott the Selfridge of the early 19th century? In other words, an antecedent that is going to be putting a dynamic into play within the 19th century and early 20th century that's here, but a little bit separate from what you were emphasizing, is the English village and things of that sort.
Absolutely. I think I talk not about Scottish, but about sort of George Bernard Shaw and his idea of Irish authenticity and how Irish authenticity is used both in literature and in advertisements. I would say even into the 18th, you can go all the way back. There's always been this attraction, right? There's always been this attraction, and there's always been ideas of authenticity, right? Often authenticity that is located in a community that's at a distance from the center, right? That community becomes the authentic. The only distinction I'm claiming for Selfridge is the mass marketed nature of it. And you could say that Scott's novels were, you know, incredibly popular, but it wasn't quite the mass market campaign that that we see in Selfridges. So, and it doesn't just arise phoenix-like anew at the beginning of the 20th century. It just takes on a particular degree of energy, and you start to see it in all of these sort of different in housing development and communities design. But there is a core of English nationalism that is often ugly, that can lie at the heart of some of the advertising and of some of the community design.
Yeah, I'm happy for the ugliness to reside with the Englishes.
Yes. Yep. Yep. No, there is. There's certainly. Yeah. I mean, I. I won't launch into Joyce, but Joyce is a you know, Joyce is a particularly interesting example in terms of what he does with the English version of the commodified authentic and appeals to Irishness in his book.
Well, this question is going to kind of, in a way, sort of extend what Eric's asking about the portability of the concept, right? The historical portability of the concept of commodified authentic. Because when you set out the initial sets of concepts that are being reconciled, and the first term you use is self-fashioning, I say, okay, Stephen Greenblatt, right?
That's right, yes.
So, you know, to take sort of Walter Scott as sort of an example and, you know, go back further, you know, what's going on with the marketing of history plays, right? When Shakespeare, you know, in sort of the first urban theater, one of the things you're selling is history plays, and I mean, frankly, sort of my sense of what you're developing, the idea of the availability of this commodity,
right,
adds so much to its appeal,
right,
strikes me as a sort of better account of what's going on in Shakespearean theater than Greenblatt's concept of absolutist theatricality that holds you at a distance. So it seems to me like a concept that, you know, that can be sort of, you know, taken out of that moment in the early 20th century. And I would say that a large part of the appeal of the history plays was the very fact that they're being mass marketed.
Right.
You know, and to come back to Jerry's question, I mean, in order to find that, you have to throw yourself into the crowd, right? That you have to be willing to go to the equivalent of Oxford Street.
Right.
Right, and sort of rub shoulders with everybody else, you know, in order. So, I mean, this would seem to me to have a kind of demystifying effect on the spectacle.
I think so, and I do think that this is it is a portable concept. Though we were talking about zombies earlier, and sort of for every era its own zombies, right? So even concepts that reappear, right, reappear often for different cultural imperatives, right, different cultural reasons. So one of the reasons I was careful to stay in Britain or in England is that it emerges slightly earlier in America, but also it has a different flavor, right, because America is for all sorts of reasons, right, that has to do with, you know, America's youngness, that commodified authenticity emerges differently there, right? But it is some of the same concepts. One of the reasons I think it, so just to clarify, I am not claiming that this is a phenomenon, right, that only appears at the turn of the century, but just that it is a phenomenon that has a particular resonance at the turn of the century. And one of the things I'd argue is that it's part of it has to do why it starts to explode in community design and housing design and literature and store design and advertising and store windows, is that it allowed. It sort of eased the passage between the Victorian and the modern. You know, Virginia Woolf says, there should have been another generation between my father and me, right? Something to cushion the contact, right? Because these modernists have these late Victorian parents. And that the commodified authentic was an incredibly appealing strategy to be both sort of connected to a kind of venerable past in the Victorians, but without being overshadowed by them, right? But to at the same time be kind of be modern. So the reasons for its people's interest change over time, I would say, even if the phenomenon itself does crop up in different places.
And just to set the historical thing aside, I was really, you know, thinking of that analogy, really intrigued by the way you describe the architecture of Selfridges with plate glass windows, right, on a sort of government or museum building, which is kind of theatrical.
Yes.
Right, and so, I mean, how do you look at plate glass window? Like, who's serving? Are you being sort of held out, or are you sort of being catered to, or?
It's all of those things. That's why, I mean, in fact, the Selfridges windows are described as little theaters when they first open, and in fact, they have curtains on either side, right? So they are unveiled, and Selfridges shifts the the window had been sort of full of stuff, right? That was the tradition, is to cram the store window full of objects, right? It could be, you know, wonderfully full, and I'm thinking about Dickens' A Christmas Carol, right? The store window's there, right? Just crammed full of stuff, a kind of cornucopia of abundance. What Selfridges does is bring this kind of, in some ways, a modernist aesthetic, right? So it was a single object, right in the center of the window, or a carefully arranged scene. But there weren't price tags, right? So it was a kind of lifestyle. Here's the living room. Here's the boudoir that you wish you had. One of the things that I find so fascinating about these store windows is the way they practice seduction, right? It's the ancient rules of seduction. It's accessibility and distance, right? Sort of inaccessibility. So the Selfridges windows were open after work hours. They were open and lighted until 11 o'clock. So people would go and see this as a kind of play, and they could sort of long for what was behind the window, and yet it seemed so inaccessible. They could go into the store and buy it, right? But that kind of tension between inaccessibility and accessibility, Selfridges exploited quite brilliantly. Yeah.
Can I add a footnote to that? I remember vividly in the early 1970s when I went to New York, and I was completely shocked when I was walking down Madison Avenue at a change in style on the display windows. The mannequins were coming out at me. I've never seen that before, and I really did stop and call this move from inside this otherwise passive theatrical space. And of course, that's now very common.
Yeah, and actually, Selfridges used live mannequins. Live
zombies.
Yeah, zombies, actually. He was the first zombie thing. Yeah. Yeah, Paul.
Just to follow this through a little bit more. I'm wondering, why then does Selfridge feature its own building so conspicuously in the advertisement, if it is this space of, you know, semi-transparent display? But even like those sort of classical figures, Monty Python-like, holding up this giant building. I'm sort of tempted to try and read the image. But was wondering about first, you know, how you would explain that the prominence of that structure, and if there are sort of ways of reading that particular image and its unique, highly angular formal properties.
I mean, I think there's a lot of discussion about the Selfridges and Selfridges architecture. One really long article actually in the Times that talks about it as this. There's a couple parts to your question. I will get to all of them. As this surprise that a store could look like this, right, from the outside, because it looked so much like a museum, it looked so much like a government building, and yet the plate glass made it like a store, right? So customers weren't quite sure, like, where to put it. But I think that the reoccurrence of the outside of the building on in all of these ads, and they really did promote this. This building was to turn it into a kind of icon, right? That this was an iconic image, but it was the image that they wanted to have store under this image, right? And not just a government building, right? That it could work that way. They actually take the name off the door, this name of Selfridges off the door after a few years, because they say that our store doesn't need any. Our store is so famous, we don't need a name on the door, right? Because the building was enough. So I think they deliberately do this in the ads to try to play try to address people's fears that they would be losing status and losing class by going to a big emporium on Oxford Street, right? That they could gain status by going to this building. The inside of the building, interestingly enough, was quite modern in that, because they got around some of the restrictions for firewalls, the space was vastly more open than any store had been up until that time. So the interior of the store had a kind of modernity in terms of its space, and yet a lot of the sort of smaller displays were sort of recreations of kind of older living rooms. Does that get to your question?
Yeah, although I'm also so curious about this image, and it's not just the building, it is a sort of skewed, almost overwhelming,
yes.
You know, as if the...
It's an ocean-going line.
It is,
yeah,
it is, it's the Titanic,
the
bow, right?
Titanic, the pyramid, you know, was the guy a Mason, like, you know, does that perspective sort of encode a kind of... I mean, for me, I'm wondering, like, does it sort of encode a formal experience that is also the paradox of the commodified authentic? In other words, a picture that is constantly calling attention to its own mediation with its sort of strangeness that also claims to just be the thing, right?
Absolutely.
So, and I found it very persuasive, your suggestion, that it is the paradox that's on sale, right? And so I guess if the picture isn't necessarily the best example of this, is there a formal dimension to what you're talking about in terms of the commodified as authentic, calling us to enjoy this paradox of the constructed original? Does this sort of, though your examples are, you know, thematic in prose, are there, do you pursue its sort of formal ramifications in, say, you know, modernist poetry at the time.
Right, okay. Yes. I'm not sure this links back to the building, but
yeah.
But the let me take an example from Ulysses, the Ithaca chapter of Ulysses, that is about home and about returning home, right, and about images of the home, and part of the way that I read that chapter, and especially certain moments in it, involves a kind of stylistic move on Joyce's part, where he gives you the advertising, he gives you the rationale behind the, you know, all in the same paragraph, the advertisement, the rationale behind the advertisement, the marketing strategy behind the advertisement, how people are reacting to the advertisement, the longing that goes into the reaction of people reacting to the advertisement, the falseness of the advertisement, as well as the a sort of, I would say, a deep understanding of the longing for certain things that are created in the advertisement. And in terms of reading strategies, if you only settle on one of those things, you're missing what he's talking about, right? Which is the kind of circulation of these images without actually settling on any of them, right? So the very structure of the paragraph, or the way that he, you know, structures various paragraphs in that chapter, demands this kind of reading process of seeing the appeal of the authenticity, deconstructing the authenticity, seeing it as a construct, and yet understanding the longing that would produce it in the first place, right? And the and that is encoded in the very sort of way he is using sentences and paragraph structure within that chapter. So there's one sort of example of how you could of how it ends up coming into a highly canonical modernist text. Does that work? Okay. Yeah.
I'm an Americanist, and so I was thinking about kind of what's going on in America at the same time in terms of these issues, and in terms of what Jerry was saying about who exactly are the consumers, who are they trying to sell to? I mean, what the way we figure it sometimes, you know, is the rise of the professional managerial class, and that those you know, after the incorporation of America, there's this new class, and that even out in the provinces, if it's still kind of that lawyer hanging out a shingle or whatever, rather than being on retainership of the corporation, there's still that new class is the one that everyone's aspiring to be. They aren't really of it,
right.
And that seems to me that there are three, I'm thinking anyway offhand of three ways in which they were kind of reached by department stores at this period in America, and that I haven't heard spoken about, and maybe it's, you know, particular to America.
Right.
And one was the magazine revolution and the rise of dime magazines, and so there's a new kind of advertising venue that just exploded in the 1890s. And then a second would be prefabrication, that some of these products you could help assemble, right? They would arrive in a crate,
yeah.
and you or local craftsmen.
Right.
Help put the furniture, the house, whatever together, or even, you know, dresses, you know, whatever matters. And then a third is the rise of mail order houses, you know, Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward's and so forth. I'm wondering, is anything like that happening, or is that purely because of the different kind of class situation and the geography and so forth?
That's a really good question. I didn't run across any sort of do-it-yourself make the kit. That doesn't mean that, you know, that they weren't there. I didn't run across any. The first category, yes, and I'll get to that in a moment. The third category, remind me. Oh, the catalog, this year's Roebuck catalog. I also did not run across a big catalog market, and I think that my guess would be a difference in geography, just the sheer vastness of the country. But I didn't run across that. Selfridges did have fleets of trucks that would deliver for you, and you could simply call up. They had actually a little play. A play, like an actual play, in one of their advertisements, where the woman was calling up Selfridges and simply ordering a vast array of goods, but not from a catalog. Certainly yes, there is an explosion of magazines and of newspaper advertising. The Times starts to advertise. There's ever more venues for advertising, and mainly what I looked at in terms of the commodified authentic was newspaper advertising, and not magazines. And there's one other thing, but it has run out of my mind. So yes, potentially to the first, and I didn't find any for the second two. Yeah.
I was intrigued by the notion that, well, you mentioned Joyce and you mentioned Suffrage and Suffrage, they were all sort of transplanted people. And I was wondering, there seems to be some sort of connection between, particularly with writers, the ability to, I was just wondering, is it some of the best marketing of the commodified authentic coming from people who are immigrants, migrants, people who see the culture from an outside? I mean, I'm thinking as, you know, far back as, you know, the stage Irishman. I mean, it was Irishmen, always Irish writers marketing themselves as commodified authentics, whether it was Goldsmith's Deserted Village, marketing the nostalgia for English villages.
Right.
Right through, you know, as you mentioned, right through the 19th century, lots of, you know, stage Irishmen marketing. But even down to these were transplanted Americans.
Absolutely, and certainly James is. I think writers in general are usually outside in some way, right? I write a lot about Virginia Woolf and the commodified authentic, and she's, you know, as English as they come, and yet obviously an outsider in all sorts of important ways. E.M. Forster. I'm also extremely English, but also an outsider, right? For various reasons. So yes, to the extent that that writers are often at the margins, it's a better vantage point. Yeah.
I can't not see a Cunard advertisement in that.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm intrigued by images where it's not, I mean, this is a photograph and not an advertisement,
But a lot of the times, like you saw in the advertisement that I put up, it's Selfridges, the building sort of plucked out of its context, right? So it's not in, it's not on Oxford Street. It's floating in the heavens, right? It's not. It has no precursors, and that was. But Selfridges himself was fascinated with things like the huge cruise, sort of the sort of prototypical cruise ships with flying, right? So he has the first I can't remember, I'm blanking on the name, the first person who flies over the channel. It's gone. But brings the pilot and his plane sort of into the store. So at the same time that he was having all these sort of craftspeople and the people from Scotland actually making the lace in the store, he was also sort of saying, like, look at this cutting edge technology. So I think you're right. I think he would have embraced the idea that his store was Titanic.
Well, one of your texts went to this point about bringing goods from all over the world.
That's right.
It seems to me to go right into it.
That's right. Just steaming in from all parts. Selfridges is. If you've ever been to the store in London now, or the store in Birmingham, you can see that they are not continuing the this tradition necessarily. They're very much, especially the store in Birmingham. Have you seen the? It's sort of basically looks like it's sort of covered with hubcaps, and it's quite a lovely building, but extraordinarily modern and very different than this. One of the things they ran into in marketing in the sort of later part of the 20th century is that they became associated with a kind of stodginess. The sort of your mother and grandmother shopped at Selfridges and you didn't want to. So when they launched their new store, they wanted to shed this old image, because looking like the Titanic was no longer a cutting edge design. Yeah, before 100 years before tomorrow, right? Isn't tomorrow the 100-year anniversary?
Yeah.
You're right. Any other questions? Probably at lunch. Great.
Thank you very much.